And next we have Michael Farrell, whose paper is entitled Break or Connection, Species Catalogs and the Conceptual Episteme of Australian Poetry.
That was the title, yes.
It is now called something else.
It's called Welcome to Skip Row. I don't know if this pun probably doesn't work in Californian, but do you have skips as big garbage bins, giant garbage bins, which also works as a synecdochic? Yeah, so we call them skips, but also that's a word for Australians coming from kangaroos via Skippy, the kangaroo. So welcome to Australian Garbage Street, I guess, and thanks for coming so early. My paper has a title as well, which is Catalogues and Riddles, The Animal's Idea in Australian Poetry. My current research project is an inquiry into the relational structures of poems which name different species and the poetics that might be construed from my findings, or the findings, let's say. The following paper examines the mode of the catalogue and more tentatively the genre of the riddle, or I could say untheorisedly, through looking at poems by Baron Field, D.H. Lawrence, Les Murray, Lionel Fogarty and Susan Hampton. It's a bit of a daggier lineup perhaps than Toby's. We'll work out percentages later. Adam's catalogue is the first animal catalogue in the Christian tradition. But like all catalogues, it provides only an idea of the totality of animals. For Hegel, Field's contemporary, Adam's naming annihilated animals and their existence as beings. Blanchot, however, alleviates Hegel's reading, proposing rather that the animal became an idea as well. Naming, then, is the first step in building a conceptual world for the named animal to inhabit and for the poet to extend. Field's The Kangaroo from 1819 is perhaps the first poem of Australian native animal species in English, and as such requires, and I think repays, an amount of attention. I keep wanting to, you know, get to the contemporary in my research, but I always feel like there's more to be done in the past, I guess. By turns, comic, pompous, contemptuous, contradictory, it provides a glimpse of the beginnings of Australian natural history. Specifically, it lays the groundwork for the framing of this iconic species in settler poetic terms. It also provides insight into early settler attitudes towards Australia, providing a pre-national perspective on Australia as land and continent. Australia is referred to in the poem as an afterbirth. According to Field, Australia is not, therefore, part of the world's initial conception. As his poem reminds us, God, all caps, blessed his work at first and saw that it was good. Field is explicit that Australia is not good, but a product of the first sinning. The ground was therefore cursed, and hence this barren wood. Australia is an anti-Eden, a bad offshoot, an unpopular sequel. Unlike the rest of the world, it is a result of human error rather than divine conception. The kangaroo and God are also humanised in Field's poem. Using a reproductive metaphor, Field writes that the kangaroo was not conceived in the beginning but emerged at the first sinning. Sinning referring to Adam, Eve and the snakes, hybrid act of sex, disobedience and the obtaining of knowledge. Know thyself, kangaroo, Field seems to be saying. There is disagreement between biblical scholars over whether, in Genesis, animals are created before or after humans. The animals, at least, were nameless creatures. There was no word for them, except perhaps that of animals in general, the impossibility of such reference contemporarily derided by Derrida. Genesis states that Adam is given the task of naming the animals who join him in the garden, but we are not told the names he confers, so we do not know which species were represented. In any case, according to Field's version of creation, there could not have been a kangaroo or other Australian animal present. Field, who despite his own puns on his name, does his best to liven up what he calls, in another poem, this prose dull land, through attention to what he calls Australia's one redeeming feature, the kangaroo, a creature so marvellous it warrants the creation of this fifth part of Earth. Such rhetoric is poetically convenient, but Field's also enjoying himself bouncing around in his head, doing a magician's trick of knots. Kangaroo, kangaroo. The word makes the poem, but he can only repeat it. He can't rhyme it with shoe. It's too new. Field, addressing the kangaroo, admits, "To describe thee, it is hard." He's trying to wrench the idea from the animal, but he doesn't know what the idea is, what God thinks he is up to in creating it. Field lists hybrid creatures from Western mythology. Sphinx, mermaid, centaur, Pegasus, and hippogriff, summing them up with a representative hybrid as chimera's all, before claiming the kangaroo too to be a hybrid of the squirrel, fragile, and the bounding hart, or deer. The poem begins with an epigraph in Latin from Virgil. I'm not sure the pronunciation, but mixtumque genus prolesque biformis, or hybrid birth and two formed offspring. Virgil's reference is to a Greek mythological hybrid not named by Field, the Minotaur. The suggestion is there that Field's English poem is the hybrid offspring of Latin and Greek. The offspring of two species is something new, but is also a limit or a reduction. A catalogue, while also a limit and a containment, presents a proliferation, an opening. Paradoxically, the notion of the catalogue suggests both agency and the already determined, that is, history. The agency is that of the maker, who, following the etymology of the Greek catalogos, enrolls or chooses the items, or in this case, the other species, that go into what is, ostensibly, a portrait poem of a single species, a kangaroo, that positively and negatively, through comparison and imaginary procreation, define it. There is an implicit analogy between the poet and God. Not that Field makes a poem in imitation of God making the world or the things of it, but rather that God makes, like a craftsperson or a writer, with a or the hand. The catalogue as a publication points away from itself, to gallery walls, to shop warehouses, as if to say there is no space here, the space is elsewhere. The philosopher Nancy argues that at first sight the art catalogue is not a text but purely an instrument of identification. Once we read the catalogue, though, according to Nancy, these indicators, these references, are in turn effaced by the works themselves, which it would seem can do perfectly without them. We close the catalogue and look. The catalogue can also function as a replacement for what has been exhibited, but never, according to Nancy, as an immediate index. As an art catalogue may refer to other museums rather than the event of an exhibition, Field's poem could be said to be a supplement to writing about kangaroos in other fields, to future poetic texts, and to that on other animals that he cites. Nancy notes that the catalogue available to the gallery goer or shopper is an appendix to the actual list of works or products in existence. There are, of course, many more Australian species in the barren wood that Field could have mentioned. Does or did the reader, however, close the poem and look? While more than a list of species, Field's kangaroo is produced through reference to short lists of different species. The first species he mentions, the Sphinx, the spirit of Egypt, according to Hegel, is mythological and can be said to represent barren or non-reproductive creation. The Sphinx is creative in both the productive and the imaginative senses when it comes to riddles, however. It has therefore a synecdochic relation to the kangaroo, a riddle which Field attempts to solve, finally giving up, ostensibly, in an act of faith. Next to Oedipus, the tragic Greek king who destroys the Egyptian Sphinx by answering its riddle, Field, the English migrant, Wordsworth acquaintance, judge and aspiring Australian poet, appears as a jester, a lightweight interlocutor. Field compares the kangaroo to two other hybrid conceits, the camelopard and the duck mole, names for animals we know better as the giraffe and platypus. Yet Field's attempt at explaining the kangaroo through two joined species, squirrel and hart, is unrelated to the name of the kangaroo, which is a pun, mishearing or translation, from the, I'm not sure the pronunciation of this actually, Gugu Yimithir word, gangaroo. His penultimate claim is that the kangaroo is nature's joke, joined, as he says, by some divine mistake none but nature's hand can make. Nature, in her wisdom's play, on creation's holiday. In conclusion, he's won over to the kangaroo and takes its side over swan and platypus. Thou canst not be amended, no, be as thou art, thou best art so. When sooty swans are once more rare, and duck moles the museum's care, be still the glory of this land, happiest work of finest hand. Again contradicting his barren wood conception, the kangaroo is praised as the glory of this land. In other words, the kangaroo is made of heavenly light, something only God could craft. Rather than naming, annihilating the animal, it seems to return it to God as God's idea, realised in light. This is a transcendent version of Blanchot's animal as idea proposition. If we return to the beginning of the poem, the kangaroo is the spirit of Australia, perhaps the breath of God or the soul of the land. Just got one picture. Where'd it go? The spirit of Australia is also the slogan of Qantas, the airline I came to the US on, which features a stylized white kangaroo as its emblem. Field's line, "Be still the glory of this land," is ambiguous. It can just as easily be read as meaning the kangaroo was created for or by the land as by God. Read in this way as if a shift happens within the poem from Christian terms to those of the land, with glory not pointing to God, but as a translational metaphor for the Christian reader, then the act of craft belongs rather to the land. The word still is ambiguous in a further sense. It may be consigning the kangaroo to death and redundancy with other Australian species, making Field's jocularity still more awful. We can see the dispersion of metaphor produced in portrait poems as being dispersed items of catalogue, without necessarily the existence of a list as such. Portraits of kangaroos, and as we'll see, lyrebirds, are, however, haunted by the form of the list and of the idea of the museum. The poem, acting as both catalogue and museum, attempts to preserve what might already be lost. D.H. Lawrence's poem, The Kangaroo, circa 1922, is set in a zoo and distributes its other compositional references throughout the poem. Rabbit, hare, python, black boy, ribbon, skis, all make up Lawrence's kangaroo. The poem then gestures outside the kangaroo's body and the zoo to insects, snakes and sun, and then further beyond pre-settlement Australia to bull, cow, stag, leopard, lion, dog, before returning finally to Australian parrots. Like Field, Lawrence uses other species and things to explain the kangaroo as if denying the spread of the animal's image in the preceding 100 years. Emily Dickinson, for example, compared herself in a letter to a kangaroo in the 1860s. The only kangaroo among the beauty is, in fact, is the quote. Explicit cataloguing occurs at the poem's rhetorical climax, perversely annihilating a representative list of animals that were never in Australia before settlement. Other species, the leopard and lion, the English Lawrence would likely have only seen in a zoo, a structure that therefore connects England to its colony and its colonising. In other texts, leopard and lion might function as synecdochic representatives of European colonialism or of the concept of native species or of the wild in general. The point of Lawrence's list, however, is one of sound. Field also emphasises the emptiness of Australia's barren wood, a theme taken up by Lawrence. I think I'm missing a word here. Anyway, the emphasis in Lawrence's version of Terra Nullius, however, is Australia as a zone of silence, while Field battles trying to fit the kangaroo into the space of the rational to make sense of the animal to readers in England. Lawrence's catalogue suggests that the kangaroo existed in a vacuum. Sound was elsewhere, if not in England, then elsewhere in the empire. In Australia, no bull roared, no cow ever lowed, no stag cried, no leopard screeched, no lion coughed, no dog barked. We all slept better then, I guess. This claim gives weight to the visual emptiness of earlier lines. Her full antipodal eyes, so dark, so big and quiet and remote, having watched so many empty dawns in silent Australia. Unlike Field's poem, which addresses the kangaroo, in apostrophe presumably, Lawrence's poem is a third-person lyric describing a scene of encounter between narrator and captive female kangaroo, Joey and Pouch. There's a similar scene in the novel Kangaroo, but the kangaroo is a male. I don't know what that means, but... Field's kangaroo redeems Australia. Lawrence's exemplifies it and suffers from it. The kangaroo's eyes are the screen onto which Lawrence projects his idea of Australia after denying the existence of any other being, apart from the kangaroo, some apparently silent insects and a snake, and the occasional parrot. An assortment not quite enough to make a catalogue, certainly not one of sounding animals. The point of Lawrence's insect and snake reference is to point to the lack of biting animals in Australia, something I won't go into beyond the obvious denial of dingo, crocodile and shark. But I do wonder what Lawrence's frame of biting as a form of presence is about. Ultimately, Lawrence's riddle is not the kangaroo, but Australia, that silent lost land of the South. If Australia had been as silent as Lawrence's poem imagines, then the lyrebird would have also had a boring few million years waiting for settlement sound. Famous for its mimetic ability, the lyrebird comes with a repertoire, exemplarily listed in Les Murray's cataloguing poem, Lyre Bird. Murray's splitting of the bird's name in two emphasises its relation to sound through the lyre. The idea of what a lyrebird is not simple, however. Confirming its identity as a songbird, its common name comes from the visual notion that its tail resembles a lyre. The first word of Murray's poem is the punning lyre, L-I-A-R, pointing to the bird's borrowed or insincere soundings. The poem's first lines begins with Murray's own lies or fictions that are more about language display aimed at seducing the human reader than description or mimesis. In line two, Murray refers to this lyrebird as hen-sized, presumably meaning the domestic fowl, but it's not until line five that the riddling, self-sandwiching catalogue begins between third persons with a shift to first person. The following list of species and things is excised from Murray's dense phrasings. Catbird, crosscut, saw, she-dingo, bellbirds, magpie, cattlebell, kettle boil, ducks, crane, not the bird kind, chainsaw, owl, human. Several of these noisy imitations contradicting Lawrence were available pre-settlement, while of course settlement has enriched the lyrebird's possibilities. Murray's framing of the poem is all about sound or song. The title, the sounds of his own language and the concluding line, their flight barely lifts them a semitone, connects the bird in general's other representative ability, that of flight to sound, and therefore, paradoxically, given Murray's metaphor, to a pre-settlement idea. Despite the poor approximation of flight, the lyrebird, like a riddle, moves from here to there. That's a definition given of a riddle. And has turned into something else, a musical metaphor, and in grammatical terms, a third person. Murray's semitone metaphor is, ironically enough, that of a colonising Western musical scale. While Murray writes knowledgeably, rather than with the bemused or contrived speculation of Field and Lawrence, the lyrebird as a species idea rather than a species is arguably emphasised even more strongly than in the poems of the other two. If an idea of Australia, it is a conduit for the land sound, rather than that of the kangaroos, of national concept, Australian space, or still less, Christian anomaly. The point of mimesis is that the imitated is elsewhere, and yet again the catalogue points to the beginnings of a complete catalogue or index. The complete lyrebird repertoire is unrealisable. Further, the notion of sound as a made present image challenges the notion of visual presence. Hearing a lyrebird in the bush doesn't mean seeing one. It may be no closer to the human listener than what is being imitated. What is absent is the original sound. Lyrebird is a much more ecological poem than the previous two, and its equalising of relations between the lyrebird and the sound makers it imitates. Critic David McCooey notes Murray's attempts to fuse rural, urban and Aboriginal strands of Australian culture in his poems. Yet the poem is also to some extent in the form of a riddle, with the sounds that the lyrebird makes diverting clues. McCooey argues, using two musical metaphors, that the scale of Murray's project produces a strain. Going on to refer to the violence of Murray's work, the wrenched syntax. The lyrebird poem specifically is paradoxical. How do you imitate an imitator? The poem marks the violence of the catalogue, the wrenched syntax that listing can produce in the eviscerating of context. Only two poems in the Australian Poetry Library, which is an online depository, feature the word ecology. Both are by Lionel Fogarty. In the post-nuclear situation of disguised, not attitude, he writes, echoing field, land ecology, never have holiday. This poem also features the brilliant phrase, writer's bastard from overseas, using bastard as a verb. It is his other poem, titled Ecology, which concerns itself with animal species, however. In 37 lines, it names 25 species, including, lastly, an Aboriginal human. The nine uses of the I pronoun refer to six species: frill-neck lizard, dugong, kangaroo, cockatoo and gecko, four-speced I, and termite. The other I's refer to the taipan's refuge, to digging sticks, to club, woomera, to seeds and to death. One use has no referent. It is a sentence containing just the one word, I, perhaps implying ecology itself. The scene of ecology mixes pre-settlement and settlement reality, or rather survival of pre-settlement reality into settlement conditions, or perhaps again the impinging outside of the poem. When the human is the final species mentioned in line 33 and is not attached to a pronoun, the question arises, if the named animals are ideas, whose ideas are they? The poem's narrator is multiple conceptual, if we take the multiple eyes as a expressing the frame of ecology. As we've seen in the previous poems, Fogarty's catalogue stands in for the implied catalogue of all the species in the places he imagines. But who selects and enrolls them? The poet does, of course, and we could speculate about the autobiographical continuum or poet-narrator relation in all the poems, but it is the voice of the narrator who lists. In Field and Lawrence, it is the pedagogical voice, the writer speaking to ignorant or innocent audience. In Murray, it is the lyrebird riddler that does the listing or naming. I mew catbird, I saw crosscut, I howl she dingo. A list may accumulate or displace. In her poem, The School Fence, Susan Hampton notes the flexible transferability of names in the catalogue of insults by children. The poem evokes the literal sense of enrolment, amusingly catalogues insects. I came out of the school fence and their voices flowed out of the yard. You faker, Sula. You're foul. Give it back. Make me. You dog. Give it back. You poofter. Lezo. You insect. I laugh and keep walking. So I've come down to the order of insects, phylum, class, species, subspecies. It's the bottom circle of hell, filled with blowflies and bloodworms, bedbugs and stunned bees, bull ants, dead but still shining rhinoceros beetles, assassin bugs, aphis, head lice, the vinegar fly with its big red eyes, 250 different species of midge, the coddling moth, mealybugs, mosquitoes, termites, thrips, millipedes. These are who you're related to. Slug moths, weevils, the damselfly and the jewel beetle, the branching veins in the see-through wings of the golden-eyed lacewing, a voracious predator of aphids and other soft-bodied insects, whose larvae look like insect versions of crocodiles. It is the little word of the insect pastoral, interpretable also in Fogarty's ecology, where butterflies are my beetles, wasps, friends. I'll end there. Thank you.